Chapter 13 of Genesis, I'm going to read it right now. Chapter 12 was about Abram and Sarah and the Pharaoh, and they had a domestic problem. And it may be safe to say, again, there's not a lot of details. It kind of tells you the story with not a lot of, you know, narrative as far as this was right, this was wrong, this is what God thought. And so we kind of have to leave it there and make decisions. Sometimes it's difficult because you'd say, well, I'm not sure what culture was like back then. Maybe that's the way the culture was, that the men would sell their wives into a harem to keep themselves alive. It's like, and I think as I, you know, you back off, it's like, no, I think that's going to be wrong in everything. You've got to consider that Abram lost confidence. He left the promised land that he was sent to because of the famine. Was that a test? Possibly. Because it didn't seem like things really worked out down in Egypt for him. He didn't build any altars. He didn't worship God. He didn't claim any land. He just got scared that he was going to die and then gave his wife away. Actually sold his wife and gained possessions. And so that could be considered a failure. And now he's going to return. He's going to return. Here's the Dead Sea, Jordan River. Here's Bethel and Ai, and he's going to return to that spot in between Bethel and Ai where he built an altar. Remember, Sechem's up here between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And he's going to end up going down to Hebron yet tonight. But he comes back up and returns to Bethel and Ai, which is north of Jerusalem right here, which is not part of our story yet. And now we're going to have a story about Abram and Lot. Now down here, we assume Lot went with him. Lot's never mentioned. Just like this story, it's about Abraham and Lot, Sarah's not mentioned. So this is another domestic situation. Something to consider, and I've got written here on the notes on the first page, and I'm going to read through this first, the promises that God has made so far to Abram. It's in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, in Ur, he says, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. So there's a land. And I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. That's the purpose of this nation. I will bless those who bless you, meaning I'll encourage people to cooperate with you because they're cooperating with me. And him who dishonors you or considers you insignificant, dishonors you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This comes after the dispersion of the Tower of Babel. Then in chapter 12, verse 7, at Sechem, when he arrives there, it says, then the Lord appeared to Abram for the first time in the land and says, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him, and that is here at Sechem, where he builds an altar, and to your offspring I'll give this land. So he has no offspring, so there's a promise that there's going to be offspring. But to consider this, it is possible that and we have Ugaritic texts and documents that explain marriage, and you can see the many things that Sarah and Abram went through. Like, for example, Sarah giving Hagar to Abram to have a son that will be Sarah's son. That's strange in my world, but that was something that was normal in that culture. That was something that could happen. You could hire out a wife to have a child with and then take the child as your own. That's in the Ugaritic texts that come from up Phoenicia and up Sidon in that area. Now, another thing is, if you don't have any descendants, you could adopt someone. The Roman emperors did the same thing. You can adopt someone into your family and they could be your heir. So it's possible that Lot, whose father was Haran, had died. And I think in Hebrew, it's actually, when you look at the Hebrew text, it's actually pronounced Lot with that O in there. I just kind of figured that out. My grandpa's name was Lot, but they called him Lot, you know, Lot Wiemers. And his mom's name was Folke Lutz, Loots. And so his mom's name was Lutz, and his name was Lot. So it was Lot Lots, or Lot Lutz, whatever. Okay, but anyway, Lot, whatever here, could be at this point in the story, in Abraham's mind, maybe the heir. He may be the one that's going to receive this inheritance or the promise, possibly. But that's going to be disqualified tonight. Okay, so that's what we've seen so far. Now, chapter 13, verse 1. So he's been promised the land to become a great nation and that there's going to be offspring that will bless all people. So Abram, chapter 13, verse 1. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything he had, and Lot went with him. So Lot was there in Egypt. Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. And that combines more detail of what that is in chapter 12. But he's got livestock, silver, and gold. From the Negev, and that's this area down here where Hebron's at, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. Then Abram called on the name of the Lord. So he comes back up here and calls on the name of the Lord. Once again, we don't know a lot of details, and you've got to be careful of reading into it, but he leaves Egypt apparently having failed. He was driven out of the land of Egypt. He sold his wife into the harem. He didn't build an altar. He didn't call on God. He fled from a famine. One of the main things is he left the land God had sent him to because he got scared. He goes to Egypt and he's scared when he gets there, so he lies about his wife, and now he's returned. There's room in this story to consider Abraham has reconsidered his ways. It doesn't say it explicitly, but he failed by leaving. He failed while he was there. Now he comes back and returns to the place he built an altar where he'd previously called on the Lord, and he calls on the Lord again, maybe to kind of say, okay, what are we doing here? And maybe, you know, we would say confess this sin or came back to the promise, because he is following God. He is trying to be obedient, but he has failed. So right here, it says, there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, had also had flocks and herds and tents. So right here, with that calling on the Lord right here, we're going to say Abram has returned to the Lord. He's back in faith in the sense that he's now trusting all those promises that I've just read to you before, and realizes God's got a plan for him, and it's going to happen here. I'm not going to run from a famine. I'm not going to sell my wife into a harem. I'm going to come back here, and what does God have for us? So he's back in the land where God, again, he doesn't have like a map of exactly where to go. He's in the land. Okay, now a problem breaks out. Lot also was moving about with Abram. And again, they're moving about because they've got so many flocks. Again, this is not an old man with an old woman on a camel walking around. Well, here, watch this verse. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. Now, why does he have tents? Because he's got people. He's got servants and people that he's responsible for. He's got his own community that is traveling with him. Now, again, we're going to find out he's got a wife. He's got some daughters. But so he's got people that are living in tents, so they're taking care. And we're going to find out there's going to be a conflict between Lot's people or servants and Abram's people or Abram's servants, and they're going to have a conflict because they've got so many things, and these are like two corporations getting in each other's way. I mean, this is a lot of people. Verse 6, but the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. Now their possessions, silver, gold, tents, but they've also got, like you saw Abram coming out of Egypt, he'd had male and female camels, he's got sheep, he's got, livestock. And quarreling, verse 7, and quarreling arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. Now to combine that problem, the Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So they're already there. Abram is, in a sense, an alien. He's gone across the borders into this other country, but there's plenty of land for the animals to graze, but there's also going to be animals grazing of the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and now they come in and join with them, and they start grazing there, and they'd have to make deals. They can't just invade the land. There's no invasion here. They're making some kind of treaty, some kind of an agreement that I'll graze my animals here. Who's got some field that I can rent or pay for? It appears Abraham maybe have one of the things they may deal with is, if you let me graze your land, I'll protect your property. It's going to come up later in the story because he's going to have 318 trained military men in his household. So he's got herdsmen, but he's also got a military that he's going to take off and defeat kings with here in the next chapter. So it's there's room to think that if he is around Shechem, or if he's around Bethel, or if he's around Hebron, you let me use the pastures, I'll make sure you are not invaded by any gangs or there's some kind of protection. And that's where he's going to have protection from. That's where Melchizedek's going to come in, because it appears Abram had some kind of treaty with Melchizedek, possibly. Nonetheless, that's kind of what's taking place right here. But right now, the problem is Lot and Abram's, their herdsmen are fighting. There's not enough room for them. So Abram said to Lot, "Let's not have any quarreling between you and me, or between your herdsmen and mine, for we are brothers." And that would be an Middle Eastern term for, you know, partners. Watch this. "Is not the whole land before you?" Now, when he says the whole land, we're going to assume he's talking about the promised land. He's talking about the Negev up to Dan in this general area here. He says, and again, he's going to do something very humble. He's going to let Lot choose. Again, that's why we go back to this. God has promised him. Now, when you go to war in this kind of a situation, God has made a promise. "I give you this land." And now you've got a conflict, and many of you have tried this. You've got, this is, God says, "This is yours." Now you've got a conflict. And so, are you going to fight Lot, or are you just going to play it out? If this is mine, well, Lot, which part do you want? Because whatever part you choose, I'm going to end up having it. It's mine. Now, he may not have said it just like that, but that may be what he's thinking. Lot, right now, you can choose whatever you want to, because eventually it's going to come back to me anyhow, because he trusts God. And they're looking this way. They're standing right here. I'm going to show you the maps here in a moment. They're standing right here between Bethel and Ai, and they're looking to the east. So when Abram says, if it's on your left, that would be north. If he says, if it's to your right, that would be south, if we're going to get literal with this. So here he says, right here, I'm going to be in verse 9. "Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. You go to the left, and I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. You go to the north, I'll go to the south. If you go to the south, I'll go to the north. Which part of this promised land do you want?" Once again, leaving room possibly that Lot is the heir of the promise. Because right now, Lot's the closest thing. Now, we know that's not the case, but that could be in play. In fact, it could be in play, but Lot is going to disqualify himself, just like Ishmael is going to disqualify himself. He's not the promised child, but he disqualifies himself. Then there's Jacob and Esau. Now, we know who's chosen, but not until, guess what? Esau disqualifies himself. So Lot is going to disqualify himself, and we're going to have a descendant. Ishmael's going to disqualify himself, so we're going to go with Isaac. Esau's going to disqualify himself, and then we're going to go with Jacob. Now, God knew exactly who he's going to give it to, but the one that it should have gone to is Lot, should have gone to Ishmael, should have gone to Esau. Each of these people is going to disqualify themselves, and it's going to come to the promised child. Okay. "Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain," very huge word, "of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar." This is before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to come back and look at this. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain, there's that word again, "of the Jordan, and set out towards the east." Wait, you go left or right? He goes east, which is fine. It's a wise choice, because that's where the green grass is. But that is where? Outside the land. So Lot is not taking the promise serious, just like Esau did not take the promise. The promise was for the oldest son. Now again, God says it's going to be the younger one, but Esau traded it. He didn't consider it valuable. He didn't consider He didn't consider the promise of God to be significant. Lot doesn't say, well, I don't want to leave the land because, you know, I'm your heir. He actually willingly looks down here and sees this area right here of being well watered and says, that's where I want to go. And so he goes this way. So he, in a sense, removes himself from the opportunity, as is Ishmael and Esau going to do themselves, which again, there's your lesson. People can choose to accept the promise of God, or they can choose to eliminate them. It's available to everyone if you want to make an application of this, but they choose to, no, I'm going to choose something else than the promise of God. He goes on in verse 11, so Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out towards the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tent near Sodom. We're going to come back and look at that word right there. That means he grazed in the area towards Sodom. It appears if Abram's going to have an area down in here that he's going to have a treaty with, it seems like he goes over here and makes some kind of an arrangement. He doesn't just invade the land with his cattle. He makes some kind of grazing arrangement that he's going to help participate in their society and offer them something, it appears, nonetheless, towards Sodom. Now it says here again, verse 13, now the men of Sodom, even at this time, were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. And that is unique, the way it's saying that they're sinning in a way that is beyond normal. That's kind of that whole verse right there kind of scares me when we look at our society on what we are doing, trying to imitate this and calling it normal. You can call it normal. You can get everybody on your own page and have them think you're normal, but it's still sinning greatly against the Lord, and there will be consequences. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot has gone over here, the Lord now, this is now the third promise, if we consider the first two in Genesis chapter 12, he's now going to speak to him. He's going to add a couple things to it. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, lift up your eyes from where you are. And where is he? He's standing right here. This is where Abram and Lot, he came back to his altar. Abram worshiped God, got back in faith, if we can say it that way, got himself back where he's trusting God. There's a conflict. Now, instead of having the conflict like he had down here where he lies and sells Sarah, he just bolds up and says, well, we've got a conflict. Let's not fight. What do you want? You go here, I'll go here. Which way you want? He goes here. So he's eliminated himself from the covenant. So now God appears to Abram right here and says this in the NIV. Lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south and east and west. All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring. Now before he said offspring, now he adds in here, you're going to get this land, you and your offspring or seed forever. Again, that's a huge word, forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth. So just like the land is covered with dust, your offspring are going to be like this dust. They're going to have to fill this whole area. This whole land is going to be yours. So that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, and this is his command to him, go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So Abram moved his tents, again, plural, because he's got a tent, but he's got servants, herdsmen, military, moved his tents and went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron, where he built an altar to the Lord. So now he goes down here to Hebron, builds an altar. Mamre is about 2 miles north of Hebron. There's a great oak tree there, just like there was an oak tree here at Shechem. Josephus records that oak tree was still there in his day, and Josephus claims that oak tree had been there since the creation of the world. That was Josephus writing. But that's where he's going to sit, and then that's where Isaac and Abram are going to live for much of their life, their activity. Now go to the notes. I've got several things to show you here in the next few minutes. Page 1, this is now the, you can see the second promise that is written there, Genesis 13, 14 through 17, where it was spoken in between Bethel and Ai. So he's received a word from God or a promise in Ur, at Shechem, and now God's spoken to him at Bethel and Ai. Chapter 13, verse 1. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the Negev. Notice it's spelled different here in the English Standard. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and in gold. Turn to page 2. And he journeyed from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai. Abram returns to the altar of chapter 13, verse 4, to the place where he had made an altar at first, and there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. Abram's now again initiating this. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks, herds, and tents. And there I've got a list of what is mentioned. Lot has flocks, herds, and tents, meaning people and servants. Abram has, according to chapter 13, verse 2 and 12, 16, sheep, oxen, male and female donkeys, male and female servants, camels, livestock, silver and gold, and many, many people working for him. And so chapter 13, verse 6, so that the land could not support both of them because they've got so many things dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. Chapter 13, verse 7, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Compound, at that time the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. Notice the word strife in the Hebrew is in a box right there. It is the word rib, R-I-B, transliterated. It means dispute, controversy, contention, lawsuit, or quarrel. So they're having some kind of dispute, some kind of quarrel. When the prophets use this word rib, it comes up in the prophets. It's God bringing a lawsuit, a rib, a quarrel against Israel, and he needs a mediator to resolve it. When two parties have an issue, they can get together and talk it out, or they can get together and fight and resolve it, or they can go to a third party, and it's called a lawsuit. This is the word for lawsuit, except it's not used that way. That's not how it could have become a lawsuit, but there's nobody to go to. Instead, they resolve it themselves, and Abraham resolves the problem. So that's the word rib. He's going to make an offer. Here's how we can do this. You make the first initiative. I'll accept whatever you choose. Chapter 13, verse 8, then Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife. There's another word instead of rib or dispute. And I've got that in the box. And you recognize that word. See right there, the word in the box, chapter 13, verse 8. The word is Meribah. You recognize that from the waters of Meribah? That is a word for quarreling, strife, contention. That's where the waters of Meribah in the wilderness, Israel in the wilderness, argued with God. They had a contention with God. And so that's just, again, you recognize both those words, rib and Meribah. It means, in our translation here, strife and strife, in both times in the English Standard. Then Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Okay, turn the page. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you go to the left hand, then I will go to the right. If you take the right hand, I'll go to the left, north or south. Point one, Abraham diffuses the situation. He's going to trust God to keep his promise. He allows Lot to select. Isaac's going to follow the example of him and do the same thing in Gerar with the herdsmen of Abimelech, the Philistine. When they start taking over his wells, he just keeps digging wells and says, well, I don't want any conflict. So Isaac learns this idea. I don't want to say passiveness, but the ideal of trusting God. You can't burn me. God has given me this land. What part do you want? You can take it, but you can't keep it. And I'm not going to do anything about it. It just, God is going to benefit me. So Abram almost has that passive, aggressive faith. And Isaac is going to seem like he's going to be a very passive individual, but it's almost like that passive, aggressive faith. Listen, I'll just dig another well. God's blessing me. You can't overcome these promises. Now, Lot, like many people, eliminate themselves from the equation by not even honoring the fact that God's a reality. Point two, Abraham sacrificed the promised land to Lot. Interesting, he actually sacrifices the promised land knowing, I can give it to you, but God's giving it to me. And he's going to follow that practice when he offers Isaac on Mount Moriah. He's going to offer Isaac knowing, you can't take it, you're going to give him back to me. And so this is almost rehearsal for Mount Moriah. He gives him a promise, and now you've got to give it away. And he does. You want the north and the south, doesn't matter. Lot chooses the east, eliminates himself. On Mount Moriah, God offers Isaac, and God honors that. Chapter 13, verse 10, this gets a little interesting if you don't mind. chapter 13, verse 10, and Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered. Now, right here, he's moving east. We've already had several stories, and we can spend a lot of time dissecting this, with Eve in the garden and her eyes seeing them getting in trouble and having to move to the east, and then the sons of God looking and seeing the daughters of men, and everything just kept deteriorating. And there's a whole series of words, like almost buzzwords, that's saying Lot's making a mistake, Lot's making a mistake, because of all the past writing that we've had so far in the book of Genesis, and compound that by referring to what's going to happen in the future. Oh yeah, and Sodom, the beautiful land, the well-watered land, is going to soon become the torched land, the like that's consumed with fire. And so there's a lot of things within these verses 10, 11, and 12 that kind of hint at Lot's making the typical mistake of lifting up his eyes and looking and choosing something that looks good without considering the promise of God or the word of God. Don't eat from this tree, but doesn't it look good? It does look good. Looks like I could benefit by not honoring the word of God. And she chooses to eat. Lot, instead of staying in the promised land, again, we're assuming that Lot had an opportunity. It doesn't say it explicitly, but so many things are not said explicitly. Like I'm saying, Abram came back up to Bethel and Ai and in a sense repented and got right with God, and God spoke to him again. Well, now I'm assuming Lot can participate in this promise, but Lot chooses, lifts up his eyes and sees something beautiful outside the promised land and says, that's where I want to go. I want to go outside the promise. Well, that moves things along a lot quicker than Abraham was planning. So in that box, it says, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. That'd be the Delta area, the land of Goshen. In the direction of Zoar, which would be this way, he's looking east. And then he mentions this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So in other words, Lot's moving right into ground zero of coming destruction because it looks good. Now, you've got to see this word. It's in a box in chapter 13, verse 10. The word is kakar. And I've got all kinds of maps there for you to look at. Kakar, kakar. Kakar, I spell that K-I-K-K-A-R. I spelled it correctly, but I spelled it very sloppy. So let me try it again. K-I-K-K-A-R. The word itself means, I've got it written right there. You can see the Hebrew. Kakar is the transliteration. It means circle, round, talent because it's round, loaf of bread because it's round, or a region, which would be a round, circular region. Comes from the root word kara, which means to move in a circle or to surround. And now, this is the hill country right here. Well, in fact, I've got all kinds of maps for you. If you turn to page 5, there I've got what is called, there is a circular disc right here, like I keep drawing a circle right here, and I'm going to try to show you a little bit here. This is Dr. Graves and Dr. Collins have done some serious excavation at Tel Hamam. I know one of the excavators that has worked there. In fact, he brought me a jar handle from there. He himself showed me a sling stone that he'd picked up, and they let him keep it while he was excavating at Tel Hamam, which is potentially Sodom. And this right here, the thing that got them going, especially Dr. Collins, is that word kakar. They're standing, Abram, you can't argue with this. They're standing at Bethel and Ai, and they're looking east at the well-watered plain. There are three ideas of where Sodom is at. There is the northern theory up here. There's the southeastern theory down here on this side. Now, this is a terrible Dead Sea, but down here on this side. And then there's the underwater, the southern theory right here, that Sodom and Gomorrah used to be right here, and then the Dead Sea, after it was wiped out, it expanded and covered them up. It's the southern basin theory. So you've got the northern theory, Sodom and Gomorrah is up in here, the southeastern theory, which is probably what you're familiar with. Most of your maps are going to show the southeastern theory. In fact, I had to change my maps online because in 1987, 88, 89, when I was teaching Bible down in Tulsa, I made a map for everything in the Bible. And I put them down here because that's what everybody did. There's also the theory, again, they're underwater here in the basin. So the basin theory, the southeastern theory, and the northern theory. But remember, they're standing here looking at the land. And I'm going to show you, and you can make your own decision on the little bit of information I can provide you. It's easy to see them looking downhill over Jericho into the plain. This is the Rift Valley. Because it's the Jordan River runs here, it slopes down, and then it slopes up into the mountains of Jordan. There's mountains out here. But there's a plain, some hills coming down here. But this is a kakar. It's a circular disc that you can still see today. And that's what's drawn on there right there. And that's from excavation. That's from other people's work. And I turn the page. I've got it again on page 6. There's a little cleaner map. A little more precise than my 1987 map. This is my 2020 map. And you got Bethel and Ai. Notice the X between Bethel and Ai, and they'd be looking east at that kakar. And inside that kakar is Sodom, and then outside, see Mount Nebo? As you move further east, Mount Nebo would be right about here. As you start moving further east, now you start getting the mountains of Jordan. So that kakar matches exactly right there. If you see that first map on page 6, at the very top, there's a diagram. That is a picture looking from the west and the east. So they would be looking from on this side. That is on the west side. That's the Mediterranean Sea coming up the coastal plain, that overland of the Philistines, the Shephelah, that's the hill country, rising up to the hill country where Jerusalem's here, Bethel and Ai is here, and Shechem is right here. And so this is hill country. They are high right here, and it rises all the way down here. Basic right here. You cannot stand here and see this. You can't. There's hills. There's hills. You got to look over hills. But you can stand here and look this direction right there. And so that's what you see right there, standing there. On that top map, the second map below that, the topography, is now you're standing, it'd be drawn, standing over here, and the map, you're looking at it from this perspective, so you can see very clearly, right there you can see Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. This is drawn to scale. So that is how high Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim is, and then Shechem would be, we saw that last week, is right in between there. Abram moved from Shechem down to Ai, which is close, you know, it's closer to Jerusalem, but it'd be right there where that X is at once again. Ai and Bethel would be about 10 miles or 16 kilometers north of Jerusalem. And he's looking down over Jericho, and you see that dotted line? That dotted line is sea level, like with the Mediterranean Sea. That is sea level right there, and Jericho is below sea level, and of course the Dead Sea is below sea level. That's why it's the Dead Sea. The water can't flow anywhere. And that was where the kakar is at, up, you know, across from Jericho. Notice Hebron, I've got that in a circle. That's where Abram's going to go at the end of the chapter. And Hebron is the highest city in the land of Canaan. You can see right there, that's the highest city in the land of Canaan. Now, that's some maps you see right there. Turn the page, it's page 7. We continue the next verse, chapter 13, verse 11. Let me read it here. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. And there again, you can see the word kakar in the box there also. It's the word again. It's the plain of the Jordan. This is the Rift Valley. And the Jordan River flows in the Rift Valley. This is the plain of the Jordan. The plain of the Rift Valley where the Jordan River flows. This, the southeastern theory, is not the valley of the Jordan. It would be the salt plains of the Dead Sea. This would be south of the Dead Sea. This is the Jordan Valley right here. Again, that's what I'm thinking. There are three theories, and people argue all of them. The problem they've got is they're excavating this place right here, and we've talked about it. They have found an explosion. It appears something exploded, an airburst explosion. We're going to talk about this later. that would have blown this whole the water up here, besides fire and brimstone falling, all the salt would have just washed up here, exploded, and buried this whole land right here, wiping out for centuries this fertile plain, this fertile area. And it would have been an airburst. We'll talk about that when we get to the next chapter. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. And there again is the word Kakar. And you can see that word, the word is Yahel. It's the first word on the second line of the Hebrew. I didn't have a chance to draw a box around it, but you can see Yahel. So it's Y-E-E-H-A-L. Y-E-E-H-A-L can be translated as his grazing rights extended as far as Sodom, or Lot acquired grazing rights. Lot went here and acquired grazing rights as far as Sodom. So he didn't just go over here and invade the land. He went over there, made some kind of an agreement, some kind of transaction, possibly some kind of military protection for the people if they allowed him to use the grazing area. And he grazed up to Sodom. This is where we see him leave off right here, grazing in up to Sodom. Pretty soon he's going to be living in Sodom, and that's where, again, it takes place. So that's what that word can mean there. You've got, on page 8, you've got some more maps. I always put an X on each of those showing you where the bottom map, for example, is looking. The bottom map on this page is looking from the Mediterranean Sea. You're looking from this way, looking this way at the whole land of Canaan. And so, for example, you can see Mount Moron, Mount Tiran, and Nazareth on the left side. And notice how high Nazareth is. And they took Jesus outside the city of Nazareth to push him down a cliff. There's the cliff. They would have pushed him off. And I've stand there. There's a place right there. It just drops off. And it falls down into the Jezreel Valley, or the Valley of, that's Jezreel Valley is the Valley of Megiddo, the Valley of Armageddon. And then it begins to rise. Notice how fast, and when you look at a map of Israel, it just looks flat. But when you look at it from the Mediterranean Sea, you can see how it rises to the hill country of Ephraim. And there you've got Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And then going on, you're going to have Baal Hazor, Bethel. Now again, they're not all lined up. They're east and west. You know, its trajectory is different. But that X, once again, is where they would be standing, right there by Bethel and Ai. And then Jerusalem's about 19 miles away, or 10 miles away. Bethlehem, and then Hebron, which is the highest city, dropping down into Beersheba, into the Negev Valley. So Abram is going to go down to the Negev, but he's going to this time settle in Hebron, looking over the Negev is where he's going to settle. There's four different maps there showing you different angles, and you can figure those out. I think I've got them labeled pretty good. It's just very interesting when you can consider the heights of those mountains and all. Okay, turn to page 9. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, here's that second message, lift up your eyes and look from place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land you see I'll give you and to your offspring. One more thing I want to point out in verse 14, chapter 13, verse 14, is that word, sometimes it's not even translated. Here it's translated in the Hebrew transliteration, or the Hebrew word for word translated now. If you notice in the NIV, it just says, doesn't even translate it in the English standard, just says lift up your eyes. The word is in the English na, na, or nay. It's used 60 times in the Old Testament, 4 times by God. It appears to be, some commentators say, an appeal. It's like, and it's been substituted for the word please. So that could be translated, some commentators say, instead of not translating it at all, or translating it like this box did, the word for word translation, now, could be translated as please. Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. He's asking him, please do this thing. Please get on board with what I'm doing. God, it's used 60 times in the Old Testament. 4 times it's used by God. Here's one of them. He used it again in Genesis 15 when he says, please have faith that your son will be born to you. Please believe this. Or nay, now believe that you will have a son. And then Nay, sacrifice your son, your only son. Please, sacrifice your son, your only son. And then before they leave Egypt at the Exodus, ask the former Egyptian masters for parting gifts. Please, before you leave, ask them for these gifts. And in every case, those are the four times God uses it. When he's asking or telling or demanding them do something that doesn't make sense. For example, look at this land. Everywhere you can see from this point, I'm giving you all this land. The Perizzites, the Canaanites, there's business, there's routes, there's trade, everything's going. This is yours. Please look and consider this yours. Same thing. You're going to have a son. That's impossible. Please believe me. I'm telling you, you're going to have a son. Offer your son. I can't offer my son. He's the one who's going to have the inheritance. Please do this. Now, you've been slaves for 400 years. Now, ask them for parting gifts. We're just glad to get out of here. We're not going to ask anybody for gifts. Please ask them. And they'll give you the gold. And they did. So every time God uses that word, at least the four times he's using it, he's telling them, commanding them to do something that he's urging them to do because it sounds ridiculous. Chapter 13, verse 16, I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Mamre and his brothers, Aner and Eshcol, are going to come up in the story. So down here is a city named Mamre. It's about 2 miles north of Hebron. Hebron is about 19 miles south of Jerusalem, but here in Mamre, that is where he's going to meet the guy that's the town's named after, Mamre, and his brother Aner and Eshcol are going to come along and assist. They're going to be partners in Abraham's life, and then that's where he's going to settle there in Mamre, and he will buy a cave, which is just outside the city of Mamre, the cave of Machpelah, or Pelah, which is east of Mamre. So Hebron is here. 2 miles north is Mamre. And then east of Mamre is a field with a cave in it that Abraham's going to buy from these guys. And that's where he's going to bury Sarah. And that's still a monument today with Herodian stones that Herod built up over the monument that was already there in his day. And that ends our story here. You've got right here on this back page just the whole map that we've talked about. And you can see the details of Sodom and Gomorrah and where those places are at. The back page right here, the two pictures on the back page are, I am standing, if you look, that I'm standing in Jericho. I'm standing on the ruins of ancient Jericho in both those pictures. They're black and white. And I'm standing here in ancient Jericho on the rubble of, you know, 1446 BC, looking over the modern city of Jericho. And you can see, look at the palm trees. There's water there. Look at the fields, the little row. You can just from there, black and white, you can see the rows, the crops planted there. And then just, you can't hardly see it. It's kind of gray there. Again, it's too low. But right where about the buildings stop in those pictures, that's the Jordan River. It's dropping down into the Rift Valley, and there's the Jordan River. And if you can use your imagination a little bit, because you can see it in a good picture, it's kind of cloudy and hazy. But you can see in the background a little line in the sky. It's a little darker on the bottom. That's the hills. That's the mountains of Jordan today. You can still see those hills in the background. So right there in both those pictures, I'm looking over the Kakar of the Jordan Valley. I'm at Jericho looking this way. They are higher up looking that way. So you can imagine if I can look that way from Jericho, these guys are higher looking over that area. They could see all this location depending on how clear it is. Can you see those pictures at all? But that's the ancient city of Jericho that I'm standing on right there. I'll pray and we are done. Father, we do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for your truth. We ask that we ourselves would trust your promise, that we would not be stingy or selfish or try to get the things that we want, but that we would relax. We'd have a faith rest life of trusting you and your promises, knowing that what you said you're going to do, you're going to do, and you'll provide the things we need as we are obedient and live our lives as responsible individuals. We do thank you again for this opportunity to hear your word and ask that we may walk in wisdom in this time. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.